This is Decentralized, the Decentralized Trials and Research Podcast. We gather here with friends and guests to talk about the latest ways to make research and clinical trials around the world more inclusive, more accessible, more resilient, and more sustainable, all by using decentralized methods. This podcast is recorded live on Clubhouse every Friday, 12 to 1 Eastern, on the TGIF DCT show at the Decentralized Trials Club. You can join the live sessions and add your voice every Friday at noon Eastern time with the free Clubhouse app by following the Decentralized Trials Club. And of course, subscribe to this podcast on your favorite platform to get notified of new episodes. Following the club and subscribing will also help you stay current for any of the bonus content we may drop. And now, it's time to decentralize.
Events. Well, today's topic, I'm really looking forward to it. It actually was percolated up by our friends over at ShareCare and was a great opportunity to hear an origin story. So we don't do a lot of case studies here, and maybe that's something we're going to find more opportunities for in the coming weeks. But we're going to dig in a particular story and a particular journey with Emily and Francesca. Before we set that up, though, just a quick bit of housekeeping. In case you tap the wrong button on your phone, you are in the Decentralized Trials Club on Clubhouse. The doors are now closed on the plane, so you're sticking around for this destination with us. But hopefully it's a good ride. If you are new to this community, you can tap the Decentralized Trials tag at the top of your screen. It'll take you to the club page where you can find past episodes. We've been recording these weekly, dating back to December, and get a preview for some events that we may have scheduled in the coming weeks. Our typical format here, we're talking about different topics, issues, and opportunities related to decentralized clinical trials and the opportunity to improve access for research for patients around the world by decoupling the need for them to have to travel to a great distance for research sites. We cover a range of different topics here, from those that are patient-facing, site-facing, technology concerns, and so on. These topics come from you in the audience, and so if there is a topic that you would like to bring forward, or if you would like to co-host, like Emily and Francesca today, just drop a line through social, through email, through here on the new messaging features in Clubhouse to Amir or myself, and we'll be sure to get you added into our cycle. We'll spend the first few minutes talking with Emily and Francesca about this particular experience. At about halfway through the hour, we'll open up the floor and give you an opportunity to jump on the stage with us and share your experience, your question, your perspective. Amir, how did I do with housekeeping today? Miss anything?
Great, as always. I'm looking forward to getting introduced to our speakers for everyone to know them.
Fabulous. Well, why don't we start with an introduction to Francesca. Francesca, welcome. If you don't mind, coming off of mute, introduce yourself for our audience who may not have met you before, and share a little bit about why you and your team thought this might be an interesting story to share with the decentralized research community here.
Absolutely, Craig. Thanks for having me. Hi, everyone. My name is Francesca Rinaldo. Just to give you a few sentences on my background, I'm a physician scientist by training. My clinical background is in general surgery. But during my clinical training at Stanford, I actually became very interested in applications of artificial intelligence in healthcare and actually worked as a postdoctoral research fellow in the Stanford Partnership for AI-Assisted Care. This sort of broadened my horizons as someone who was on a very straight and narrow academic medicine path, and these experiences really led me to make the transition into industry in 2021 when I joined a Palo Alto-based startup called DocAI as the director of the clinical team. We were shortly thereafter acquired by ShareCare, now are part of the ShareCare family. And currently my role in the organization is Senior Vice President of Clinical Product and Innovation. And I'm the Chief Medical Officer for SmartOmics, which is our platform for decentralized smartphone-based clinical research. Really excited to be here today to talk about the journey from conceptualization around this study of myasthenia gravis patients and the applications of our technology and how we're continuing to progress with that research and how it has opened up so many additional avenues for research that I think will ultimately benefit patients. So again, thank you so much for having me here.
Fabulous to have you here, Francesca, and thanks as well to your colleagues over there for helping to bring this topic forward. Emily, welcome to TGIF DCT. Introduce yourself for the audience who may not know you and share a little bit of perspective on the topic you'd like that we're planning to cover today.
Sure. Thanks, Craig. And thank you for having me on this clubhouse. I feel like I'm literally envisioning us in a clubhouse in a tree somewhere. I just love that visual. But it feels like we're, you know, in a secret society. But, you know, this is definitely not secretive work, and I love that we're sharing it widely. So I'm Emily Kunkka or Emily Lewis. Sorry, I'm getting used to my new last name. And I am currently at a company called UCB Biopharma, but my history in the last 15 years or so has been really clinical operations work. So I'm really passionate about actually doing the clinical trials. So several years back, I got involved with a startup called Science 37, which was completely focused on decentralized trials. And ever since then, I've really been excited about how we bring trials to patients and how we figure out how to better reach patients where they are, how to measure them better, how to really bring them into the fold to be active participants in the research experience. So I'm really interested in AI, how we can use data in different ways to get better insights on clinical insights on patients, and really believe that we can harness the power of technology and digital to make the healthcare experience better for both patients, healthcare providers, everybody within this whole ecosystem. So yeah, really excited about the conversation today. And apologies, I'm out of breath. I'm 7.5 months pregnant, but I'm a little winded sometimes.
So you have set up a cadence of milestones, it sounds like, from new name to this top 17 recognition and throwing in a newborn along the way.
Yeah, it's been busy times for me. Yeah.
Nicely done. Emily, before we get too deep into this particular project, you have an interesting job title, Global Digital Transformation Lead Neurology at UCB. What does that mean? What do you work on every day?
So it can mean many different things. I'm on some wearables projects in which we are looking at better ways to do virtual motor exams for neurodegenerative diseases. But I'm also on projects like this that integrate AI and decentralized trials and look at different ways to bring the research to the patient and like I said, measure them differently and better. I'm also on lots of consortia projects, so thinking about how we can pool data together across the industry so that we're all not wasting a lot of money doing our own things in silos. We're really sharing what we're doing pre-competitively. I'm also in, efforts where I help lead my own digital health roundtables to really get experts in the field together to talk about topics of interest that maybe people within my company aren't familiar with. So really bringing in change management and new ways of thinking within the company to really stretch people's, imagination. It's a many hat role. And a lot of it is talking to key stakeholders, getting their buy-in on things. And it's even some internal sales work, trying to, so I'm working with our incubator in which the flagship incubator company that I brought in was Winterlight Labs in vocal biomarkers. So really working with them to see where we can do some interesting projects, because there's a lot of applications of vocal biomarkers across immunology and neurology, which are our two therapeutic areas of interest. So I do many things, but that's the Cliff's Notes.
Thanks, Emily. So for today's conversation, there's a great story that I think this audience may enjoy, and it's a bit of the origin story about some of the work that you've been doing in myasthenia gravis. And there apparently was an unmet need, impacting patients and impacting researchers around opportunity to measure better, and a story about how those insights were gleaned and how different solutions may have come forward. So maybe what we'll do is, Emily, if you can baseline us a little bit on what was the challenge at UCB, and then we'll flip a little bit over to Francesca to learn a little more of some of the strategies that started to emerge together to be able to address that challenge. Emily, can you help to set us up a bit, though, on what was the challenge that the team at UCB was identifying with patients in need of addressing?
Yeah, so UCB is very interested in learning more about the natural history of myasthenia gravis. It's traditionally been known as a snowflake disease. And so lots of patients present quite differently, even though they have the same disease. So we were really interested in how we can better characterize myasthenia gravis symptoms and flares across patients. And so we wanted to help build a tool in which patients can objectively measure their symptom severity using a tool that's already in their pocket, potentially, which is a smartphone. So we wanted to harness both the camera and the microphone on the smartphone in order for patients to take selfies. And the selfies, the objective of the selfie was to look at ptosis or eyelid droop, and use the microphone to record audio samples in which we were looking at dysarthria and dysphonia. So we completed a study in which it was completely decentralized. Everything was participant driven data collection. They never set foot in any brick and mortar facility. This was all during COVID. And there were active tasks that we asked the participants to take part in before they did that selfie and audio clip collection. So for the camera portion in which they captured their eyelid droop, they were fatiguing their eyelids by counting and looking up for 4 seconds. And for the vocal clips, we were asking them to say things like pa pa pa, ta ta ta, ka ka ka, ma ma ma, buttercup, 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 and holding ah for as long as they can. And so those, you know, would fatigue, obviously, the muscles of the eye and of the throat. And from there, we were able to record samples in which we were able to label and gain a lot of interesting information from. So our ultimate goal was to develop AI models which better characterize subtypes of myasthenia exacerbations. And we're hoping to use that to predict flares. So ultimately, these models we're hoping will be used to create a personalized tool for patients, an app that'll allow them to more objectively track their symptoms and share that data with their healthcare providers in order to facilitate better care management conversations and even make lifestyle changes. So we're really looking to empower patients to better self-monitor and self-manage their disease.
So there's a number of different use cases you're hoping to realize here, it sounds like, as it relates to this measurement, potentially to impact both research as well as patient self-care and self-management?
Yeah, I mean, we're looking to really help people look at their own trajectory towards exacerbation and understand their own flare frequency and severity. And the goal is really for patients to work with their healthcare providers to avoid or mitigate the worsening of their symptoms to eventually avoid myasthenic crises in which they would find themselves being hospitalized. So that's, you know, really what we're looking towards is really reducing keeping them out of the hospital.
Francesca, at what stage did you and your team start to get involved with UCB on this particular project? Was it early on as these different measurements were being considered? Was it a little later on when the study to qualify this measurement was being designed?
I think our team was involved fairly early in the conceptualization of the study and really trying to understand how we could leverage all of the capabilities of the platform that we work with to really collect that rich and, you know, multidimensional data to gain a better understanding of how MG patients experience these symptom progression and regressions, as Emily mentioned. And so, what, you know, we approached this in really several ways. We looked at all of the different sort of buckets of data that we could potentially gather to really create this complete picture of the, you know, the natural history of myasthenia gravis for participants who were in the study. And so we, you know, used a number of different methodologies to do this, and Emily has mentioned some of them. One of the things we did is we adopted a clinically validated instrument called the Myasthenia Gravis Activities of Daily Living Assessment. And this really was a way to create a digital daily check-in in which patients could report on their symptoms, their symptom severity, and their self-reported exacerbation status. They were also able to report on how their MG symptoms impacted their health-related quality of life by using a weekly video journal-based format of another clinically validated assessment, which is the Myasthenia Gravis Quality of Life Assessment. Layering these data streams really allowed us to track how self-reported symptom burden, exacerbation status, and quality of life scores varied over the course of the study for each participant. And really layering these data streams actually was quite fascinating because it allowed us to visualize quite clearly the periods when participants actually were experiencing those self-reported MG exacerbations. Another way, of course, that we are able to capture data and was of great interest when early discussions on the study were happening was the ability to really give participants the option to opt in to contribute data from their wearable devices. And this is something that Emily works closely on with UCB. And we were specifically interested in measures of physical activity, of sleep, so we could observe how these patient-generated health data streams varied during exacerbation and non-exacerbation periods. And then finally, you know, as Emily so eloquently described already, we wanted to capture that video and audio data of participants performing those active tasks to elicit those specific symptoms of myasthenia gravis. And in the design process, you know, our team worked closely with neurologists and speech-language pathologists who advised us on the best way to elicit these symptoms, which is how we came to the exercises that Emily already described.
I'm curious to learn from you both if there were any experiences that surprised you along the way. What might have revealed itself that maybe there was an unexpected learning or an experience that required you to have to make a pivot or a change, either in the planning design in the study or the experience of patients or other stakeholders who were involved? Francesca, maybe you could start with that one.
Sure, absolutely. I think for me, there were sort of two big learning points from this study that that surprised me. The first was how challenging it can be to create a really well clinically validated data set, especially when we're thinking about video and audio recordings. As Emily mentioned, you know, we were recording these selfie videos, these audio clips of participants performing these speech exercises. And what we realized is that labeling tasks related to creating that gold standard data set that can be used to train and test a, you know, an AI model can be very, very subjective and very dependent on the expertise of clinical subject matter experts. So one of the, I think, the most interesting pieces of the research for me was to actually work with speech language pathologists to design a labeling protocol and really go through in very great detail and create this richly annotated data set, which is something unlike any other publicly available data set that we've seen in terms of the richness of the labeling, the sub features of the speech pathologies. And so that was a really wonderful learning process for how to collaborate across disciplines, you know, clinicians, AI engineers to create that. The second piece that I think really surprised me in the study is how we gathered feedback from participants and really some of the themes that emerged from the research that were absolutely fascinating and to me quite unexpected. One prominent theme that emerged in our analyses of survey responses and semi-structured interviews that we conducted at the end of the study with a subset of the participants was that being part of the study really gave them a sense of belonging. Participants shared sentiments like, And these are quotes from participants, actually. Just being able to participate in the study made me realize that I'm not alone. It somehow felt better knowing that I was part of a group sharing in a common condition and issues. It was good to feel like part of something bigger than yourself, something important, something that could push back against an illness. And so I thought this was very interesting because even though there was no specific community component to the study, participants were reporting that just being a part of this type of research could give them that sense of community and make them feel less alone in their condition.
What an interesting element, right? That, you know, we know that patients clearly want to find one another, find patients like them, and it's often a default that that means social community or other forum like that, but how simply the act of participating in research gave at least some of that hint of community and connection, feeling like they were a part of something bigger. Amir, your thoughts as you're hearing the work that Emily and Francesca have been driving?
Sure, and Craig, you know, being the neuroscience and tech guy, this is right in my wheelhouse, right?
We set up a softball for you today.
So I would have dozens of questions, but I'll just start with a couple. Just to kind of zoom out a little bit, we use lots of terminology. Not everyone in the audience might be sort of experts in them, but I'm sure everyone can Google myasthenia gravis in case they don't know in their area. But obviously, this is a sort of autoimmune neurological kind of condition in terms of muscles and nerves and can be quite dangerous. Not great treatments at the moment. But what I would like to hear is, I love the way, Emily, to use the term snowflake. Many people may not be familiar with that. Emily, do you want to just define that as you see it? Because I think it's an interesting term as a snowflake condition.
Sure. I mean, just as a snowflake, I guess no two snowflakes, from what I understand, are the same. They all are slightly different. They're all snowflakes by category, but they're all different in, I guess, the way they look and present. And so that's sort of the analogy we make when we call myasthenia a snowflake disease, is everybody has the disease. They all have similar symptomatology, but it's presenting differently. So you may have, certain clusters of symptoms that happen at the same time for different people. So just looking at some of the work that we did, we had about three or four different clusters of people who presented similarly, which was promising for us. So we looked at people who had arm and leg weakness plus shortness of breath, people who had eyelid drooping plus blurred vision or double vision. And we had different categories of people that that presented similarly. So that was exciting work for us to be able to kind of start to begin to cluster. But yes, they all present very differently. Yeah. So it's challenging.
No, I love the term, and I think not uncommon in neuroscience, right, where we can have different patients actually not overlap at all in symptoms sometimes. So it's interesting. The other question I had for you, Emily, was from a UCB perspective. Can you give us a little context? I mean, this is obviously a decentralized or prospective observational study with RWE. Give us context for this. Are you developing a specific treatment? Was it just trying to understand the condition within your therapeutic area? Or what was the context? What is this driving towards?
Yeah, so we are ultimately a drug development company. We have a drug called Rozumab that is in a phase 3 for myasthenia, but we are actually building a platform that will be agnostic of this drug. So the platform will be called LumiMG, and it will, you know, be a tool for patients to go on, track their symptoms, understand their own trajectory of symptoms. And like I said, self-manage, hopefully. So we're not there yet. We're very early. We're building the algorithms that will support the features in this app. But the app will be completely, it will not have UCB's name on it. And it will be a tool that we've worked to develop that lives outside of our drug development platform.
Great. I was hoping to hear about that because, so would you say that in terms of sort of helping patients, do you see that as an evolution where, you know, pharma companies become more of a disease management companies versus, you know, necessarily connected to a particular, medication?
Yeah, I think there's definitely an opportunity to help patients manage themselves and help them communicate better with their healthcare providers, you know, whether or not we know that they're on our drug. You know, we have a social responsibility to make sure that we're treating patients in a 365, you know, degree view. We want to make sure that we're not only serving them with our drugs, but other ways, right? And that could be completely digitally. And so that's part of our ambition in building apps like Lumi.
Great. And Francesca, do you have any comments on the questions I asked? Anything to add to what Emily's saying?
Sure. I mean, you know, we're really excited to be on this journey with UCB and really take, you know, the early findings and the foundational AI models that we've developed specifically for the intended use of symptom tracking. And now, you know, further this work by starting to take them down a regulatory pathway for software as a medical device and make these tools widely available in a very clinically and analytically validated way. To me, you know, as a clinician, as a researcher, that's really the definition of, you know, going through this process of accelerating the cycle from research to care. And it's incredibly exciting to be on this journey with UCB. And we love, you know, their vision for how to provide the tools for patients to self-manage in this rare and very debilitating condition.
Fantastic. Craig, I think we're coming to the bottom of the hour. Do you want to do the reset?
Absolutely. For folks that are just joining us, you are in Clubhouse in the Decentralized Trials Club. We gather here every Friday, 12 to 1 Eastern, 9 to 10 Pacific, talk about different topics related to decentralizing of clinical trials and research. How can we make research participation easier and more accessible? We cover a range of different topics. These come forward by you, our participants in the community. Today's topic was shared with us by Francesca and her team over at ShareCare and brought in our friend Emily from UCB as we talk about their journey exploring unmet needs and measurement and prediction for people with myasthenia gravis and the journey that they went on from ideation through development and validation and where that may be headed now. So the second half hour, this is when we open up the floor for you, the audience. If you have a question, a perspective, an idea that you'd like to add to the conversation, go ahead and use the hand-raising icon down at the bottom of your screen. We'll pull you up on the stage. You'll be on mute initially, but then just feel free to stay on the stage after or jump if you need to. First up to the mic is our friend Shalin Beg. Shalin, for anyone who hasn't met you before here, please feel free to introduce yourself, share your question or perspective on today's topic.
Thank you. Fascinating discussion.
Shalin, I don't know if that's just me, but your audio is really weak. Amir, is that you too hearing that?
Correct, yeah.
How about now?
No, it's still the same. You sound like you're sort of three rooms away from the microphone. While Shalin maybe fixes that, and it's great to see Jane. I have a quick question while maybe Shalin can fix that. Francesca and Emily, one question that I wanted to ask you was, you kind of described the platform, the types of assessments that you did. I'd be curious to know what, first of all, you know, the length of the study and what the adherence rates were with patients willing to continue kind of doing the videos and the PROs, etc. I'd love to hear some details about the adherence rates, especially longer term.
That's a great question, Amir. So the study was actually a 3-month observational study. We enrolled and onboarded about 113 participants with generalized myasthenia gravis, and about 82 of those participants finished the trial in its entirety. The interesting thing about adherence is that we actually planned the study in such a way so that we could make mid-study adjustments to adjust the user interfaces based on participant feedback to help improve adherence levels if they were not optimized at the beginning of the study. So we actually conducted recruitment in two waves. The first wave of participants went through, completed the study. We actually did a series of user interviews and surveys with those participants to understand what could be improved in the user interface And some of the feedback we got from them was really great. They wanted more visibility into how they were doing and their task completion, more visibility into their own data. And so we actually were able to make those adjustments, of course, going through the IRB to make those amendments to the protocol. And then our second wave of recruitment adherence jumped from about 50% to over 70% adherence for all of the study tasks overall.
Great, thank you. So, Shalon, can you all join us again? Let's see how you sound.
Testing, testing.
Beautiful.
You're on.
All right, fantastic. So I'm Shalon Vig. I'm a medical oncologist, and I'm the VP of Oncology at Science 37, and I've been thinking a lot about decentralized tools, and my question to you all is around recruitment. And when and how you went about identifying people to recruit onto your platform and your entire digital solution. And the second part to that is when how do you suggest folks think about the regulatory requirements in terms of enrolling a diverse group of patients to your studies when you're preparing your submissions to the regulatory agency. So more around recruitment and ensuring diversity around such digital solutions. And congratulations on your work. Fantastic. I really enjoyed that oversight.
Thank you so much. Maybe I can start, Emily, and you can jump in when you feel inspired. So to answer your first question about recruitment, we used fully decentralized recruitment methods. So we approached myasthenia gravis patients through various social media channels. We used a designated web landing page where they could read about the trial, watch videos, understand why the research was being conducted. Again, we really pride ourselves on giving participants a very high level of visibility into how their contributions are going to contribute and advance the research. If they were interested in the trial, once they visited the landing page, then participants could self-attest to a series of pre-screening questions, which were essentially self-attestments to the inclusion criteria for the study. And we intentionally left the inclusion criteria very broad because we wanted to be as inclusive as possible in this initial feasibility study. We ended up screening, just to give you an idea, over 500 myasthenia gravis patients, of which ultimately 113 ended up enrolling in the trial. But one of the things that we really noticed was the fact that using the decentralized methods for recruitment and also keeping the inclusion criteria relatively broad actually let us engage with a much higher number of potentially eligible participants than what we ultimately intended to enroll in the trial. So that was a great learning experience for us. Going to your second question, I absolutely agree with you. This is one of the most challenging aspects of recruitment and something we're thinking very, very carefully about as we embark on the process of taking the AI models down a regulatory pathway. Based on the data we have from our initial study and the AI models currently as they stand, we know we're going to need to recruit a larger sample size of patients with myasthenia gravis, which is inherently challenging because it's a rare disease. But we also need to ensure that we're including a sufficiently diverse population of patients, as you said, with regard to gender, age, race, and ethnicity, particularly for one of our models, which detects landmarks around the eyelids and then makes an objective measurement of ptosis by estimating the margin to reflex distance, which is a measurement essentially between the pupillary light reflex and the top of the center of the upper eyelid. To understand how much eyelid droop is actually present. And as you know, eyelid morphology can vary greatly across age, across race, race and ethnicity, across gender. And so it's very important for us to have a very representative population in the study.
Great question, Shalon. Thank you. Any follow-on, Emily, Shalon, anything else on this topic?
No, I'm really excited that that their recruitment was successful and they had broad representation. There are some studies that are suggesting that we need to be very intentional when deploying decentralized tools. And I think what this highlights is that it really depends on the disease type that's being studied and how that group is engaged and then how the study is engaging the community. So here really, it seems like because it was a bottom-up approach and they were engaging from the community themselves, that reflected in the success for recruitment. So that's fantastic. Exactly the way we want that model to be replicated across different disease types. Fascinating.
Great point. Thank you, Shalin. Stick around. And Jane, welcome to the room. Introduce yourself if anybody has not met you before. Share your question or idea today.
Hey, good morning, good afternoon. My name's Jane Miles. I work at Curebase and think a lot about patient experience and access as part of decentralized trials. So, Shalin, I loved your question. I have sort of a follow-on question inspired by thinking about patients who have long-term conditions and how their disease and treatment journey actually impacts their ability to get into trials. So the questions are two. One, do you know if, or did you measure how many of the patients who actually got into your trial had been in previous clinical trials? I'm curious about that. And second, can you elaborate a little bit on the inclusion exclusion criteria and how you thought about that to allow a broader access to the trial? Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for your great question, Jane. So to answer your first question, we actually did not specifically measure how many of our participants had actually participated in prior myasthenia gravis related studies. But what we did actually ask them was, what is the time period since you were initially diagnosed, and what were your primary reasons for joining the study? And what we found was actually very interesting. A good proportion of the study participants had actually been recently diagnosed, and one of their motivations for joining the study was really just to learn more about their new condition and to really understand how they could start thinking about tracking and self-monitoring their own symptoms. So that was really, really interesting aspect of the study. To go into a little bit more detail about the inclusion criteria for the study, we required participants to have a documented diagnosis of myasthenia gravis, which was one of the study tasks actually. In order to enroll, you had to provide some documentation of a myasthenia gravis diagnosis. We asked that they have ocular and or bulbar speech symptoms because we were very interested in capturing the ptosis, the dysphonia, and the dysarthria through those video and audio exercises. But other than that, we kept the criteria very broad. They had to be over the age of 18. They had to reside in the U.S. for the duration of the study. And they had to have a smartphone to support our research application on either iOS or Android.
A quick follow-up. Did you get any pushback or feedback from IRBs around that smartphone requirement?
We did not. We worked closely with an IRB that, really worked to understand the decentralized format of the study and the fact that our platform is primarily smartphone-based in the way that we conduct these studies. And so, our platform is actually, our research app is supported by a very wide range of devices. In fact, in this study, we had over 60 devices on both the iOS and Android operating systems that were represented. And so we really strive to keep it as inclusive as possible in terms of individuals who can participate using their own smartphones.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your answer very much.
And thank you, Jane. Stick around and let's turn over to Matt. Matt Walls, welcome. Introduce yourself if anyone hasn't met you before. Share your question or idea today.
Thanks, Craig. Thanks, everybody, for allowing me to ask the question. It's great to hear this conversation. I was thinking about the recruitment aspect as well. And Francesca, maybe you touched on this a little bit, but I'm curious if during the recruitment process for this study or for the upcoming phase three, if any digital measurements were used around the vocal or physical characteristics of the patients to qualify them. And so did you use them in the phase two as part of the qualification process? I think I got the answer was no. And do you plan to use any digital measurements for qualification in the phase three as you're recruiting?
We did not use any digital measurements to qualify the patients for the initial study. And we're in the process of designing the follow-up studies now, Matt. So that's certainly a consideration. You know, we want to make sure we're enriching our study population for the symptoms that we're actually interested in validating the performance of the models on. So I think you bring a great point.
Okay, thanks. That'd be fascinating to watch and learn from if you did, because I'm not aware of that being used today. I'm with TrialB. I should have said that up front. And TrialB kind of has a platform for innovating around recruitment. And it just was not something I'd seen becoming common, but this might be an interesting study to try that out on. So
definitely a great use case. Yeah.
Thanks.
And thank you, Matt. We do have one question in the chat I will put out to I think Francesca. Anand asks, was there a patient support portal for the study? Did the participants have the ability to interact with one another? I think you hit on that a little bit, Francesca, but can you just expand on that for Anand?
Absolutely. Hi, Anand. So there was patient support for the study. The patients were actually able to request either technical support if they had any questions related to using the app through the app itself. We also had a dedicated study support where the participants could interact with the PI during the study, and they could access all of that contact information and send messages through the app as well. The participants could not interact with each other. And as I mentioned, we didn't design a specific community aspect to the study, partially because, you know, we're concerned about the potential introduction of different biases as participants were interacting with each other. But this is definitely something we've talked a lot about. You know, once participants finish a study, for example, does it make sense to create a community component where they can interact, share their experiences, where you can then share information that comes out of the study with that larger audience of participants so that they can really see how their data contributions are contributing to forward progress in the field. So I think you bring up a great point. I think there's a lot of room for innovation in this area, and it's definitely something that's on our radar.
Creating community around research participants just makes sense, and I know that for studies that are blinded, I realize that there's anxiety about peer-to-peer communication during the study or even group communication during the study. But in reality, it's already happening. It's just happening outside of a study-specific platform if it's a large trial. So the idea that we can enable some elements of community building even during the study, even if the content has to be embargoed or released by a moderator beforehand, is not unrealistic at all. It's a great question. We have another question in the chat. Francesca or Emily, I'll leave this to either of you, and Kevin, we might have to pull you up if there's some follow-on here because it's a good one. The question reads, can you talk more about labeling data points? Did you have a clear idea before what to ID, and or did you discover new data points which became important through the process? Francesco or Emily, would either of you like to comment on that question from Kevin?
Sure, I can start, and then maybe Emily can jump in as well. So we were faced with sort of two distinct labeling tasks. The first labeling task was focused on the video data that was acquired while participants were performing the lid fatigability exercise. So just to remind everyone, if you joined a little bit late, I know Emily mentioned this earlier in the discussion, but what that really is it's a bedside test to elicit ptosis that works very well in myasthenia gravis patients because, as you know, as skeletal muscles fatigue, these symptoms become more prominent and they can improve with rest. So what we asked patients to do was actually look directly into their smartphone camera to get a baseline, then to sustain an upward gaze for about 25 seconds, and then look back into the camera. And looking back into the camera then would allow the ptosis, if it was present, to become apparent. So what we actually had to do was do a labeling task for eyelid and eye landmark points on a frame-by-frame basis in the video data. And this was not just tedious, but challenging, because as I mentioned before, there's a wide variety of different morphologies in patients, but also if you consider the fact that we had over 60 smartphone devices represented in the study, and that the data quality obviously varies from smartphone to smartphone, but also from patient to patient, this is an incredibly challenging task. We actually learned that the quality of the data is extremely important in terms of the model performance. And so what we're working on now is trying to understand how we can improve our user interfaces to guide participants even more to collect that high quality data. You know, what is the lighting level? What is the angle of the camera to their face? What is the distance of the camera to their face? And really giving them that feedback in real time so we can ensure that the highest level quality data is being collected. And then, you know, labeling of the speech data was an incredibly challenging task. We collected a series of over 10 exercises and then went through with speech language pathologists and really curated which tasks we thought would be the most important based on the speech pathology features that are most prevalent in myasthenia gravis patients. And those ended up being dysphonia, which is like a hoarseness, a breathiness, a weakness of the voice, as well as dysarthria, which is slurred or imprecise speech. So really understanding from them clinically which exercises we should focus on to then understand which features we should be extracting from that data. And then going through and labeling not just for the presence or absence of those pathologies, but also very richly labeling for subqualities of those pathologies to get a very, very good understanding of what exactly it was that we were trying to detect in the data. And we actually have some publications that will be coming out that are forthcoming later this year, where we detail this process, in a lot of detail. So happy to share those with you, Kevin, when they're published.
This is some really exciting work, and I love the conversation around this topic. That note at the end, certainly around getting this work published. We have an initiative within DTRA that Jane is very close to that's capturing evidence of impact of decentralized research so that we can aggregate bodies of evidence. I'm sure there would be some great connections there. I'm sure this story has more to be told, and it may make for a great case study, Amir, at CNS Summit or other forum later this year.
Absolutely, that'll be very relevant to the audience there for sure.
Emily can bring the baby and head on down to Florida to the CNS Summit in November.
I'll be off of maternity leave by then, so that's perfect timing.
This is fabulous. Amir, you must have some other questions on your mind, this being right in your sweet spot. Sorry, Amir, do you have other questions on your mind for this topic?
Yep, sorry, I was talking to mute, which is unusual for me. I pressed the mute button, but didn't unmute it. So I think Craig asked you guys, was there anything that surprised you? Was there anything that confirmed your biases or anything else you learned to really trying to sort of implement this kind of study?
Uh,
I guess it's anything that we confirm that this work is difficult, right? It's not straightforward, especially as we embark on the regulatory pathway towards clinical and, you know, analytical validation of our models. You know, we want to make sure we have all the right experts in the room, and we do this right and do it right the first time. So I think we knew it would be a challenging road ahead, and there are a lot of people involved, not only from an expertise perspective, but from a, you know, a third party perspective. So not only are we working with Sharecare, but we're working with other, you know, the device manufacturers themselves, potentially to build the app. So there's a lot of different folks, cooks in the kitchen. So I think we knew it would be challenging, and I think that that has been confirmed that, you know, it's not easy work. So I guess just from a logistics perspective, we knew it was ambitious in it, and it has been.
Great. Francesca, do you have any comments to add to that?
No, I really agree with Emily that this has been such a challenging but also rewarding journey. And as we start to plan the next phase of the research, sort of, you know, the nuances and the challenges keep emerging, but I think it's going to be well worth the effort.
Great. So I have a question. I think, Francesca, you mentioned this was a 3-month study, correct, for the patient?
Yes.
So what happens to these patients? They finish the study, you know, is there any contact after? Are we supporting them in any way? Are we going to utilize the knowledge we've gained in terms of, you know, holding on to those patients going forward for other programs? What's the thinking around that?
So we actually, at the end of the study, once all of the data collection was closed, we re-engaged with participants by sending them a report of their own data from the study, really giving them a summary of all of the data they had contributed over the course of the 3 months, and really giving them some insights. You know, here are the top three symptoms that you reported. Here's when you reported them. Here's a graph of when you reported, when you self-reported exacerbations, what your MGADL or symptom severity scores were at that time, what your quality of life scores were at that time. And it really gives a good picture of what their experience has been over the last 3 months. One of the things that I thought was so interesting about how participants were using the app was that they gave us very specific feedback at the end of the study that completing the daily symptom check-ins and the video and audio exercises actually gave them an opportunity to check in with themselves and be more self-aware of their symptoms and how they were changing from day to day. So ultimately, what we heard is that this gave them a heightened sense of control over their illness by giving them the ability to adapt their behavior for better self-care. And so, you know, I think this was largely one of the motivations for pursuing the research that we are now, because many of the patients actually reached out and asked, could they continue to use the tools in the app after the study? And when we surveyed them asking, you know, if there were an MG-focused app available to you to track your symptoms and really provide educational materials, would you use it? And the overwhelming majority of participants said yes. And so, yes, we did engage with them by providing, you know, their data, giving them insights into their own data. And we plan to reach out to the same population for the next study as well.
That's great. You know, I'd be curious to know if they were able to use any of that data to inform their clinicians, right, about that tracking, which I'm sure the clinicians would have found helpful who are actually looking after them clinically, right?
We actually did get feedback from participants about that the study report was a really useful tool for them to bring to their neurologist. Anecdotally, I remember one participant replying in one of the interviews that, you know, their neurologist was 200 miles away and they didn't see them very often, but this was a really great tool for them to convey, you know, in that short 15, 20 minute clinical appointment where they're face to face with their clinician, the answer to that question that every physician asks, you know, when they walk into the room, which is, how have you been doing? And this gave them a very objective way to do that.
That's great. The other thing that makes me think of is some work I did a long time ago now. It seems, in MDD, in depression, where we actually developed an outcome measure called most troubling symptom. If you think of sort of most depression scales, you know, they're not necessarily relevant to all the symptoms. They're measured to a particular patient. And we were developing a program where we really asked the patient at the beginning, you know, what were their most troubling symptoms? And that was actually the primary outcome measure, which was very meaningful to the patient. So especially in a disorder like this, where, you know, as we discussed earlier, the symptoms really can be very different for different patients. It's kind of just an interesting concept, trying to understand from the patient, you know, what is their cluster, and really using that as the primary. So, Craig, I think we're at the top of the hour. Do you want to take us out?
We are at the top of the hour. This was fabulous conversation. Thank you so much. First off, I have to do a shout out with thanks to Xenia Framrose, who's been quietly in the room today, but is the voice who first set up this topic for us. And so tip number one, if there's a topic that you'd like to bring forward on future gatherings here, even if you don't want to be the voice at the top of the room, let us know and we can help build some connections around that. But I absolutely also want to thank Francesca and Emily for bringing this work, this experience, this story, and your expertise forward in this room today. Having a case study like this to make it real for folks is absolutely fabulous, and you've been doing some incredible work that I'm really looking forward to following further. And of course to Shalon and Jane and Matt for jumping on the stage with us, and to the voices that were adding some questions in the chat, Anand and Kevin and others. This was really, I think, one fabulous conversation that we're all looking forward to following. If you'll be at BIO, if you'll be at DTR, at the DIA this month, be sure to drop in on the CNS Summit reception at BIO and the DTRA and CNS receptions that are happening at DIA. Find out more on social feeds at DTRA and the CNS Summit, or follow Amir and myself. Follow other folks that you've seen here in the room today, because some fabulous voices lend to the conversation. Amir, any other final thoughts?
No, wishing everyone a fabulous weekend.
Outstanding. We will gather next week when we talk about decentralized trials and diversity. Do they really make a difference? So let's demystify some of that a bit with some of the folks from Thread and some of their academic partners that they've been working on to help generate and explore some evidence on this topic. Stay tuned next Friday. We'll see you then. Thank you.
Take care, everyone.